Hello, this is Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with Sean Ware. Let me tell you a little story before we start. Introduce you to Sean. About 15 years ago, when I was doing some work with the Johns Hopkins Center for American Indian Health, I was conducting workshops on how to do documentaries at their camp called Native Visions. We were teaching young people from the res on how to make a documentary about their lives and their families' lives. And one of the young men in our group kept talking about this guy who was, like, for him, his father figure. A young man, his name was Sonny Shoyo, and he was saying that this guy ran his drum group and that he's a very cool guy and really interesting and we should meet. And then at the end of the camp, they traditionally play a basketball game between the kids on the res and the professional athletes who run this camp called Native Visions, a sports camp for Native kids. That's where I met Sean. And I won't belabor the entire story there, but from there he invited me to his home and to take part in a sweat at his house in the sweat lodge, and we met that way. And ever since, we've been friends. I've been going back and forth to Wyoming, and Sean and his wife Claire, who's here for a convention because she is an enforcement officer around environmental issues when it comes to gas and oil drilling on the reservation. The family came in, their daughter Jade with them as well, became friends with my daughter Maisie. And so they're in Baltimore. So we thought we'd take advantage of this time and introduce Sean Ware to all the folks listening to this program. And Sean, welcome. Good to have you in the studio, brother.
Hey, it's glad to be here. I never thought I'd be in Baltimore, but here I am.
It's your first trip east too, right?
First trip this way.
So one of the things we talked about the other day that really struck me, because we do a lot of programs here about education and charter schools, and there's this whole movement in America, some supporting charter schools, some opposed charter schools, people saying it's a detriment to the educational system. But you described the education system in Wyoming, the two towns surrounding the reservation, Lander and Riverton, and the schools on the res itself. And your school is a charter school, right?
Our high school is a charter school. We don't have high school in Fort Washakie. We have a high school in Ethity. And once the kids finish at Fort Washakie, they have to either go to Lander or Wind River or a boarding school away from the, like in California or South Dakota. And so some of the people got together and they formed a charter school, high school, which gives them another choice to go to. And I believe it's a positive thing for the kids there because it allows our kids to stay home, stay with grandma or their little ones in the mornings until it's time, you know, someone else can come home and give the care that the children or the grandparents need. And then they can come to school and they can work from, you know, 10 to 11 if they want, or they can get there at 7 to noon and then go home and then take care of their kids or their grandparents or even their chores, because we have people that work on ranches there. And a lot of the times they need to be available at the home. And the charter school allows them to come in, work at their own pace, and continue to get their high school diploma, which is really good. Other than that, they have to, get a GED. And although a GED is good, it still doesn't carry as much weight as
a high school
some
diploma.
Person, yeah, as a high school diploma.
So the idea of the charter school is like built around the lives and needs of the community and not trying to fit some kind of foreign format into a place that doesn't work.
Right. And with the charter school, it's not only designed to help them out, but if you want to move yourself in a quicker pace, I guess, you know, if you want to finish high school in 3 years, it allows you to do that. If you want to commit yourself to working over the summer at the charter school, you can continue your education and be done in 2.5 years.
Wow.
You know, and maybe a lot of the things that we were facing when we were at getting the charter school going was that they were afraid a lot of kids would come in and do that. And I don't know why that would be a bad thing, but they thought it would be. And, you know, with our one of the things we've had a problem with is the dropout rate. according to the numbers, it looks like we have a high dropout rate, in which they drop out, and the numbers don't show that they continue on with their education, and it doesn't show that they go on to college. It doesn't show, you know, they become successful people. Mm-hmm. They just show the numbers, well, they dropped out. That's not good, and I don't know how it shows out here. I understand. I don't know if you guys have charter schools around for a while.
Charter schools has been a phenomenon here in Baltimore. Baltimore is probably one of the leading places in the country for charter schools. And they've been around for started maybe 5 years ago or more. They've become really highly popular in the city. But different than what you're describing.
Do they allow them to come in and, you know, show up at 10 or 11 and leave at 3? No, they have to be there.
They're there. It's a regular school day. They're like 8 to 4, 9 to 3, whatever that school day happens to be.
So it's designed to be self, what would you call that, where you just work yourself?
Some of them are.
The online teachers.
Some of them are. And some of them are just specifically geared towards a certain skill set. Some of them are alternative ways of teaching, more open. Some of them are more strict. They have different models. You can use one's a Montessori school. You know, they have different ways of doing it so that kids can come in and do it. But what you're describing is something really kind of very unique. I mean, one of the things you said to me, we were talking about this the other day in the car, was that the high schools around the reservation had no Indian teachers.
Yeah.
Right?
That's correct. That's maybe because we hired them all, but I still doubt that. We have more non-native teachers at our school than we do native teachers.
Uh-huh.
And we're getting more and more as time goes along, but who knows why. But, yeah, the surrounding schools don't have that many native teachers. We do have the teachers we do have at our school are really great, you know. Most of them understand that they're working with children that have a different way of learning as far as, you know, we're a 99.9% native there.
Right.
You know, it is a public school, but we also have classes for the teachers to help them understand how we have different learning styles, I guess, where we're more of a hands-on and show me mm-hmm. compared to the here's the book, do it. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you show them how, take the time to really care about your job. The teachers that do, they seem to last quite a while there. And the ones that don't have the time to or understand how we learn, you know, we learn the same, but it's easier for us to show me.
Right.
You know, show me how it's done.
So in your particular case, I'm really fascinated by the role you play in the school as a teacher. I mean, you have this one student that you focus on for his whole time. Talk a bit about that. That's really very unique. I never heard that story before. I heard you doing it.
Well, the student I work with, he's been at the school for quite a few years. He just turned 18 the other day, and he just finished his first book on learning how to read. It's not because, I think it's because maybe he didn't want to learn how to read then or whatever. He's really easily distracted. He can, mm-hmm. you can be working with him on a program and all of a sudden he's looking out the window wanting to go play baseball. But, you know, it took 18 years. He's 18 years old now. We just finished his very first book on him to read. And when we first got him to reading, it was totally by accident. I believe he might have a little bit of dyslexia, but I had printed off worksheets for him to practice his handwriting. And one day I was on the computer and I printed off some other worksheets for him to practice his handwriting, but the lettering was in small dots, really small dots. And he kind of picked up the first word, and I noticed he started to be able to read the next word and continue on. He can read some words, but he could never put them together, you know. And the dot somehow allowed him to put the words together so he could continue and make one whole sentence complete. And I thought that was really cool. He thought it was cool, too. We had been working on letters and the words, and we could never make a sentence. But through that program, it allowed him to read these sentences. And then I continued to do these worksheets, print them out for him. And he was just so amazed that he was able to read that some days we'd do one or two worksheets, and some days we'd do 30 or 40. Because he was just so happy to be able to read. You know, we worked on the multiplication, add, subtraction, but he told me one day, he goes, "Sean, the one thing I want to learn how to do is read." That was a year ago. We worked on that, and then finally this year, I told him, by the end of the year, we'll have you reading. Well, August, September, October, we had him reading really good. And end of August, we finally got him to be able to read a book. He was really happy. His parents were really happy. His grandparents, who are very traditional people at home, they really honored me one day. They brought me over a couple of gifts, you know, a Pendleton quilt and a star quilt. And that was really an honor because they were so glad for him to be able to read, because I was able to do what all of his other teachers weren't able to do for years, you know, get him to read. And I don't know why, you know.
Well, the idea that you were actually working with him one-on-one, too.
Yeah, one-on-one.
He's your only student.
My only student in the charter school. He's the only student I work with. They allow me to work the way I want to with him. And what's really neat is I don't have my supervisor, or I guess the teacher. I'm the teacher's aide.
Right.
I have a, he has a teacher, I'm the teacher's aide, and I work with him the way I feel that works best for him. He could get up and walk out of the room any moment without even looking at my teacher, you know, the boss.
Right.
I guess I could call her the boss, but she's really not a boss. She tried to be one day, and he just blew her away, and she's like, "No, you can, this is all yours." So they allow me to teach him in any way that I think he can learn his best at. So some days we'll get up and we'll jump in the Suburban, go out to the lake and collect rocks, you know, collect other things. Go look for sometimes some herbal medicines, you know, or whatever it takes to get his mind to thinking about, you know, schoolwork and not running off and playing. But the way I work with him is like a hands-on. We go out and we do it. You know, we also go out and we'll feed horses, and we'll go out and say, "Well, how much hay do you think he needs for a day or whatever, you know? Do you think that's too much?" I like working with him.
That's clear. You like working with him. And I think the idea that what you just said, that if you can feel or see him needing to move, you just take him outside, get in the truck, and go where he has to go, and then come back to whatever it is you have to do later.
Oh, yes, because, you know, he's very fortunate, because a lot of the students can't do that, get up and leave when they want. If they could, I think they'd have a better learning environment, you know, even if it was to go outside for a few minutes, come back in. You know, a lot of the teachers that I've worked with there, they just don't have the patience to say, "Okay, take five. When you're cooled off, come back over here, get back to work." I didn't really know too much about the special ed and how it worked, but I was working as an aide in the eighth grade, and they had some other children that were having problems learning. Didn't want to listen to the teacher, so they brought me down there, and one thing led to another. I worked with these students, got them back on track, and then moved me over with some other students, and next thing I knew, I wasn't doing my job, but doing their job, and I was like, And they asked me if I want to work in special ed, and I said, "No, I like my job where I'm at." Well, now, here I am in special ed.
And you also driving the school bus back then, too, right?
Oh, yeah. I still drive that.
You still drive the school
when
bus?
When they get in a bind or when we want to take a field trip and they're short a driver, hey, I got my license. Let's go. We can go anywhere we want.
You mentioned a minute ago, and I think that this is maybe for our listeners who don't understand, I haven't heard this before. The place that you live at Wind River Reservation in Wyoming are mostly Shoshone and Arapaho people, right? And you talked about your student whose family is traditional. Could you describe what that means?
Traditional, let's see, how could I explain them? Well, traditional, you know, you got your elders. How many people still respect their elders, you know? I noticed out here in Baltimore, how could I say this? I was kind of like treated with respect. You know, I seen this guy hold his kid back and let me out of the elevator. You know, I'm not that old, but I was older than the kid. And I was like, well, that's cool. As far as traditionalists, they still use the, they're very spiritual. You know, you have, at home we have spiritual healers and we also have, you know, our doctors, you know. Native doctors that work with different sicknesses in the body, and also we have our doctors that work with the spirit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is, and his family is traditional. They do both. You know, they can help you out in mm-hmm. either way, with spirit or any sicknesses that may come upon you. Or, you know, they also have. They're very traditional. They keep one of the sacred pipes, you know, they call it the old man for the tribe, which has been around forever. Very traditional. I don't even know if they work, but, you know, they...
By work, you mean working a regular 9-to-5 kind of job.
Yeah,
right.
9-to-5. They don't do that kind of job, but they're very, very busy. Traditional people, if a member of any tribe ask them for help, they can't say no. They don't charge you any money for their help. If it's at 2 or 3 in the morning, they still get up and come to your house and help you. There's no time schedule, you know, like you said, 9-to-5. No, I need help right now at 4 in the morning. Can you come over? And they'll be there. You know, that's harder work than 9-to-5, I believe. And, you know, they don't say no and they don't brag about the things they do. You know, and they don't talk about the things they do. But if they're unable to help you, like, let's say, maybe you got kidney problems or something, mm-hmm. you know, well, they'll say, well, we don't work on that area, but we'll send you over here and we'll talk to them and they'll send you to another person that has medicine for that particular ailment, you know.
Native medicine. Native medicine comes out of the...
yes.
Right.
And one of the things about where we live is some of the doctors in town can't help you. And then a lot of the people there maybe aren't into the traditional medicines, so they go to the doctor in town. Well, the doctor in town can't help you, so they'll say, you need to go see so-and-so and let them help you. And a lot of times when it comes to that point, if they send them back to one of our medicine people, and they help you, they're able to cure you. But if you go back into doing the ways you were doing, that's only a one-time deal, you know. So let's say you have cirrhosis,
mm-hmm.
and you're dying in the hospital. Well, they know where to send you, and they can cure you. But if you take one more drink, sorry, you know, that's it. You know, so it's a tough life.
It is a tough life.
It's a tough life. You want to live? Well, here's your chance. Do you really want to live? It's up to you.
But that's also part of your life, right?
Yeah. As far as me helping them out like that, no, I don't do all that. I can help you out, you know, spiritually, your well-being, and make you feel good about your life,
mm-hmm.
in which we all should, you know.
So I remember when we first met, I sometimes remember, I forget what year it was. I think it was 1994, 95. I forget the exact year it was. But when I first met you and you invited me to your house and we went into the sweat lodge. I went to a sweat lodge for the very first time with you and everybody else in the sweat lodge at that moment. Men and women were all Native, Yellow Bear, all the others who were there at that time. And you walked me through it, I remember. You walked me through it. You walked inside, and you said, "Here's the guy who keeps all the tools and does all the stuff. And on this side sits the spiritual leader, who would later be Joe when he showed up, Joe Waterman. And the host sits in the back." And he said, "You said, whatever you do when you sit here, don't sway because you'll burn your ears off. Stay." And if you felt really like it was getting too hot, you can fall to the earth and breathe in the dirt. It's called falling to the earth. Then put the sage to your nose so you can breathe if it gets too hot. If it really gets too hot, you said, you just yell out, "For all my relations, and we'll let you out." So I wasn't about to do that. But it was an amazing experience. But I think that it would be interesting to talk, if you could talk to our listeners for a moment about the power of the sweat lodge, and what it really means, and what it means for you, because you do it often.
Well, with the sweat lodge, I guess, let's go back here a ways. The sweat lodge, I had never asked to run the sweat lodge. Just like in other religions, you know, I guess there are certain people that do certain things. And I notice in other religions, if somebody wants to be a preacher or something, they go to school for it and they learn all about the Bible or whatever it is they want to learn about. But in our way, if you want to be a medicine man, you don't ask. If you want to run a sweat, you don't ask. You'll never get it. If you want to do, you know, if you want these things, they'll never come to you, you know. The elders, they decide who's going to be the next healer. They decide who's going to be the next person to run the ceremonies for the tribe. They're the ones that decide whether you should have these medicines or not, you know, because like the like all things, you can use these medicines for good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it takes the elders to have a selective, very selective on who they're going to have come up. So at an early age, there's people in the tribes, I'm sure in all tribes, that have a calling, but, you know, they'll watch them through their lifetime and they'll see them go out and fast, maybe sun dance, maybe do other ceremonies that others just don't show an interest in, yet there's some that really show this interest. As far as myself, I would like to go out into the hills and fast. So I would fast for 3 or 4 days, whichever, and it really, really was a calming time, you know. It's really, really peaceful out there. When you're by yourself, no food or water, and you're starving, and you start to notice all the creatures around you, you know, the ants, the spiders, everything. You start to see the spirit in everything, you know, like everything's alive, but until you slow down to that pace, you don't see it, you know, you really don't see it. One of the things I noticed after I was out there fasting was that a lot of people, you don't know when you, well, let's go, when you go out and fast, you have a sweat,
mm-hmm.
you fast, and then when you come back in, you sweat again before you eat. And when you go out and fast, it's by yourself out there. There's other fasts, you know, different ways to fast, just like there's, I guess, different churches in the non-Native world, but when you fast, you're by yourself. And, well, after a few days, you realize you're not by yourself. But after so many times of fasting, I had come in, and I was very fortunate to meet some very powerful elders out there, which, you know, were leaders in their tribe as far as spiritualists and healers. And I had gone out a few times fast. And then when I come in after so many times, one of the men gave me the right to run a ceremonial sweat. You know, although I'm not a healer or any of that, because the way I conducted myself among them, I guess. And then I was given certain medicines from them to use in the sweat. That's how I got into that. One of the things they told me about the sweat, when you're given that way, they can take the time and they can sit there and talk to you for an hour, 2 hours. The old man that gave me the sweat, he told me the guy that gave it to him when he was a young man talked to him for 2 days before he ever explaining everything about that way of life. And he goes, so, and he told me, I don't know if I'm going to talk to you for 2 days or not, but we're going to talk about it, you know, and we did. And then one of the things he told me was, you never charge for this. You never charge 1 cent for it. If somebody needs help, you help them. You don't charge them money. You don't tell them you want this. You don't tell them. You just do it. And out of the kindness of their heart, maybe they'll give you something. And if maybe they're less fortunate and don't have material things in life, you know, a prayer is what they can offer you, which is really cool, you know, because a lot of the times I get to meet some of the best people in the world, even yourself. You know, I got to meet you through the sweat.
That's right.
And we have built a really huge sweat lodge now at the house. And even to this day, after, would you say, 94, 95, it seems like every time we sweat, we have someone new shows up that we meet, and it's really, really awesome to meet another person, you know, not just from there, but from all over the U.S. You know, we've had a Jewish rabbi in there once, you know. That's, you know, I believe there's a lot of Jews out here, yep. A lot of Italians. I don't know what's all out here, man. I heard so many different languages and hear so many accents out here. It's just really neat.
One of the things you said, you know, I was thinking about the sweat, and there are so many people in this world right now who are, I would call, spiritual hustlers.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, when I first when you first invited me, and Joe Waterman was one of the four, I don't know what you would call him.
Four old men
of the Arapaho Nation. Invited, let me stay, and it was a really very special evening. I felt like I wanted to do something for Joe, and you remember you said to me, well, get a pack of carton of Marlboros, take a red bandana, just put whatever you can, $20 up in it, and just take it to his house. So I did, and gave it to him, and he and I had a long talk that day after I drove past his house, a really long talk again, and I just sort of hit me was, then you read all these ads in these newspapers, you know, sign up for $5,000 and we'll give you spiritual enlightenment. That's, it's just made you realize these spiritual hustlers are out there doing this, which is totally against the real traditional way.
Yeah. I really don't know what to say about the spiritual hustlers, but I guess they're all out there in every religion.
Yeah.
You know, I see the guys on TV driving the Mercedes with the gold rims, you know. Yeah, there's hustlers out there, and like I told you before, the way that I practice, there is no charge. You know, there's no charge, but there is respect. Like if I go sweat somewhere, I like to take some tobacco or even some material items, anything, just pay my respect for that person for running the ceremony, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And even it comes to meals, you know. You may not have no money, but you cook a meal for those that are sweating. And that's, I guess that's a payment, but it's not a, it's not you have to do this. You have to pay this amount. No, I believe all them guys are hustlers and each their own, I guess. You know, if they want to make a buck, well, you know, I just wish the best for those that are paying that buck because, you know, that's not right.
We're talking with Sean Ware. Sean Ware is a special ed teacher and an artist and a photographer and a poet and many other things. He comes to us from the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming, where he lives with his family. He's here in Baltimore because his wife, Claire, an amazing woman in her own right, is here at a workshop in Baltimore. Their youngest child, Jade, is with them. And we'll be right back with more of our conversation with Sean Ware, so stay with us. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's New E-Zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I'm here with Sean Ware, somebody I've known for, I don't know, 15, 16 years, something like that. He's here in Baltimore with his wife. They are from the Wind River Reservation in Wyoming, which is Shoshone and Arapaho, and joins us here in our studios for a conversation. And Sean, I guess as we go on to a little bit more, the reservation is mostly Shoshone and Arapaho, but you're Kiowa, right?
You said that correct. I am Kiowa. which shows you a little bit about learning about the spiritual ways, you know. I learned those ways up there in Arapaho and Shoshone country, even though I am Kiowa. They were willing to share something that they believe needs to go on into the future to help our people continue to survive, to be strong, you know, with these traditional ways we have. It allowed our ancestors to continue on, even though they had really tough times and really hard times. Through prayer and ceremony, we continue to be here because of their strength and their belief in these ways. And so by sharing our ways and allowing our children to learn these ways in the proper way, because we don't change the ceremony at all. It's the way we're taught, and that's the way it'll continue to be. Then we're guaranteed our children will be here in the future, and generations to come will be here. And yes, I'm a Kiowa from the reservation. It's really different to be in a big city.
It is different, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I never seen so many cabs in one place.
I mean, because I know it's different. Be different for you even before you got here because of the way every time I'm visiting with you over all these years on the res that you always tease me about being so fast paced.
Oh yeah, Mark, you are a fast paced person. Run 100 miles an hour. Takes him about 3 days, and finally, when he leaves the res, he's down to, you know, school zone speed, 20 miles an hour, just calm, collective, ready to get back to the big city. Even your voice slows down. You know, right now you're really talking really fast, but when you're up there, you eventually come down to earth, and then you're like, hey, Sean.
It's true, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It is true. It is true.
And I notice things are starting to pick up around here the longer I stay here, so I'm cutting my time off short till this Saturday.
You're coming back?
Yeah, I got to go slow down. No, we did sweat before we came out here, which was really cool. And, you know, it's really great to be here.
Well, it's good having you here. We're all very excited that you were coming to visit. And one of the things that I was thinking about as we were just talking a moment ago is that it sounded like it was an easy transition. I mean, you met Claire in college.
Mm-hmm. Sure did.
And her mom was teaching.
Yeah.
Leona, her mother, was teaching in the college.
Yes, that's correct.
And then you moved up to Wind River after you got married.
Yeah, that's how I graduated college. It's not what you know, it's who you know. I'm learning the ways of the world.
So how different is life between growing up in the kind of small town, you know, farm atmosphere where the Kiowas and other Native people were placed and the life in Wind River?
Well, I guess it's like, let me take a moment and think here. Where I live there in Oklahoma, there's a lot of Indians, a lot of different tribes. Everywhere you go, there's different tribes. And there's a lot of non-natives. I guess it could be like a checkerboard, you know, in Oklahoma. In Wyoming, you have the reservation and surrounded by all the non-natives.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you leave the reservation, you seem to have in the surrounding towns, a lot of racism, you know, which after living on this earth so many years, you get used to it. It's not right, but, you know, you can't change the people. And it just makes me think, you know, like, how can these people still be like this, you know?
Right. I remember a story you told me that really struck me about that. Because in the East here and in communities, people always fight against Walmart being built anywhere. And I said to you there was a big fight in Riverton, a town which actually stole land from the reservation to make their town, their white town, back in the early 1900s, late 1800s. And I asked you what you felt about their expanding the Walmart because we put these small businesses out of business. And you said, I don't really care, basically, what you said about the small businesses. They don't want our business. They won't hire us. Walmart gives us jobs and wants us in their business. I mean, it's all in perspective, you know?
Yeah.
You know?
You know, and the town didn't want them there because they were going to close down the small businesses. Well, what the heck, you know? I mean, it's I don't know what to say about that, but Walmart actually gives back to the community, you know, as far as helping out the needy, you know, like at Christmas time or whatever. And I haven't seen too many of the small businesses do that. Don't get me wrong. There are a couple.
Right.
I could name them on one hand, but, you know, there's a lot of businesses around there that won't help out in any donations as far as helping the needy.
So one of the I said about you earlier was that you have you're a very multifaceted human being with your artwork and your photography and your writing, and it's not like you would say, oh, I'm an artist, oh, I'm a this. You just do it.
I do it because I like it. It's fun. I don't make any money at it, I guess, but I still do it. You know, it's something you like doing. It's like breathing air. You like to breathe air, so.
And this is air.
Yeah.
I was glad you brought these two things with you because I remember when, I guess, I don't know what it was, 5 or 6 years ago, when we were out there and we taped a little piece that we still have. We have an air that we should, which was you reading all the poems that you wrote in that first kind of book of stuff you put together. And you have a couple here with you now, right?
I sure do. I'd like to, if you don't mind, share this one about a headdress.
Mm-hmm.
It's a war bonnet for those of you. We call them headdress war bonnets. But you know, not everyone gets to wear them. They have different ceremonies in different tribes where they do wear them, where they bless them, how they earn them. And most of the times you're given this, almost all the time, you're given the right to either make them. Someone gives you the right to make them, and then you make the war bonnet. You know, me, I have been asked to make war bonnets. For, well, the first one I made was for Pat O'Neill. He was still, you know, he's a veteran. I believe of what war? I can't remember. He's about 79 now.
Maybe Korea?
Maybe. I'm not for sure Vietnam, what war he'd have been in. I know it wasn't Vietnam, but he was really cool person who's laid back, doesn't ask for anything, doesn't say anything, you know, but he's just a really neat person to know. And his son, Dennis O'Neill, is a good friend of mine, and he wanted to get a war bonnet made for his dad, so he come and asked me, and, well, I made a war bonnet, but I used all the traditional ways. I didn't use the needle and thread. I didn't do any of the modern style, I guess you would say. I had used horsehair and the traditional eagle feathers with the plumes and the weasels, and then the designs on there on the headband. I learned to do quill work, you know, with porcupine quills, and so I even used that to the horsehair to tie that down, which is, when I do something, I really want it to be something that person will really be proud to wear, you know, because once it becomes his, you know, when he puts on that war bonnet, that's an extension of his spirit, you know, of his life, you know, of his ways of being a warrior, you know, in the wars for the homeland here, you know, making sure we're able to say what we want and practice our religions, you know, without them being out there in the trenches, I guess, you know, we wouldn't be able to have our freedom we have. So after that, I thought about, you know, I'd like to write something about headdresses, because when you're working on them, you just learn to think about, you know, the feathers, how they earned them, what they did to earn these feathers. Excuse me. And the more you work on it, the you just really think about all the veterans. And I mean, it's just something, you don't make it in a single day, you know. It takes time. Every evening, every other evening, you never rush it. The war bonnet I made for him, I think, took me 2 months. 2 months just to make the headband part, and then, you know, a couple of weeks with the feather work. Takes 3 complete tails, you know, and there's 12 feathers on a tail, so that's 36 feathers. It doesn't sound like much, but when you're using traditional material, I guess, you know, then it takes a while. So while I was working on his, I wrote a poem, and I called it Headdress. And headdress was come to me in my head because I thought about all the people in the past, all of our ancestors in the past that had war bonnets, and those that were given the war bonnet, and those that were given the right to work on the war bonnet. But I didn't want it to be too much. I wanted it to be short and simple and to the point. And if you'd like, I'd like to share it.
I'd love you to share it.
I call it headdress. Instead of war bonnet, I call it headdress. Because war bonnet makes me think of war. Headdress makes me think of a war bonnet, but being in the sense of, you know, we're not always at war. Sometimes we're at peace. So that's why I call it headdress. Feathers from the past, traveling a warrior's path through peace and war. Now they are here, warriors. We must continue to pass the spirit on down the trail of life. Future warriors shall see, protecting their honor, protecting you and me. Keeping the spirit of the warrior in these sacred feathers, their spirit protecting through peace and war. That was Headdress.
I like that.
Yeah. But
let's see, that wasn't the only headdress I made. I ended up making another headdress for a
guy that was feeling pretty well down on his health. You know, his health was dragging him down. He was feeling kind of like a sick person does, you know, not feeling very well. You know, his spirit was not as alive as it should have been. And his wife came to me and asked me if I would make him one. Well, on his, it was pretty cool because you get to thinking about other stuff again, you know, and him being sick, I was thinking about all the legends and all the stories you hear about, you know, the end of the world. You know, they have creation stories. A lot of tribes have a lot of creation stories, and I believe the non-natives have Adam and Eve, you know. And
do you want to do this one as well, or would you?
I want to read another poem here for you while you got me.
Please.
While these are out, you know, I write poems, and I did a lot of photography, and I never thought about putting the two together. And then one day I said, "Hey, that poem would go good with that picture, and that picture would go good with that poem," you know. And I just kind of put the two together finally. Still don't make money. Don't care if I do or don't. You know, it's just something I'm sure my kids will be glad to have and in the future, you know, their kids and so forth.
Right, and your friends.
And my friends. And I think it helps out in school, too, with the kids, because when they have to write, you know, they're like, "What? We don't want to write." And then you say, "Hey, man, I write poetry." And they're like, "Oh, okay, we'll try it out," you know. And it's cool. It opens up a lot of doors. It relaxes a lot of the kids at school, you know, that don't really want to write. And then they can, because you can't write anything wrong in poetry, I think. I think it's totally up to you and the way you want to express yourself. This next one is a poem with, I went and I took several stories from different tribes about the end of the world. You know, in different tribes we have different stories, and just to touch upon this poem before I read it, you know, I read about the beaver, and once this beaver finishes this dam, this great dam across this big river, the world's going to end, you know. But before he does, there's always a flood that knocks this dam down. And then I talk about the old lady who lives down in a cave, you know, and she makes this berry soup. Well, as soon as this berry soup's all done, you know, and she gives it all out, then the world will end. But before she does, someone comes along and puts more berries and water in there, you know, because this, her dog that she has sitting next to her is blind, so he can't guard. But she's so old, she doesn't know the dog's blind, so when she's gone, you know, they put the berries and water in the pot again. But she doesn't know the dog's blind, you know. There's this. It was just a poem I wanted to put together because, although they're end of the world stories, they're also showing. They also tell about how the world is going to be here for a while because there's always something keeping and making sure all these events never finally end, you know. They never complete their task at what they're doing, but they never stop doing it. They just continue and continue. So with that said, I'll go ahead and read this poem for you. As False Face plays a twisted melody, Spider silently continues spinning her never-ending web. The smooth cedaring tunes caress gently across Mother Earth. Elk people dancing, buffalo wallowing, comforting beaver's busy routine. Peacefully he gnaws, slowly, very slowly. Old lady, black dog too, down in the earth so deep, hears the life-giving music as she offers white buffalo woman a taste of her sweet berry soup. Arrow boy, high on the mountain, listens as it flows through his people. Bring upon its song a melody of harmony, so relaxing, coyote was put fast asleep. So beautiful the gift, all the winged floated upon its stream of comfort. Sisters of the Great Dipper, brother stars too, cherished the gift. Carried upon raven's wings, sharing the tune with all the heavens. Northern light reflects her sacred dance, sacred colors among all the peaceful path home. Dance with the winged, the four-legged, all water creatures too, the sky above, the ground below, in between and every direction. Listen to the music of the cedar flute, which is played for only one reason, for love, love of life.
Sean Ware, welcome to Baltimore, brother. Good to have you here in the studio.
Glad to be here.
Thank you so much. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break. Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.